part of the Bible, the New Testament. We're reading in the first book of the New Testament, the Gospel of Matthew. We're going to read at the end of chapter 19, and we're going to read into chapter 20. If you have one of our green church Bibles, you'll find these words on page 987, or the words will appear on the screens through the building. In verse 27 of chapter 19, we have these words. Peter answered Jesus, "We have left everything to follow you. What then will there be for us?" Jesus said to them, "Truly I tell you, at the renewal of all things, when the Son of Man sits on his glorious throne, you who have followed me will also sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or fields for my sake will receive 100 times as much and will inherit eternal life. But many who are first will be last, and many who are last will be first. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire workers for his vineyard. He agreed to pay them a denarius for the day and sent them into his vineyard. About 9 in the morning, he went out and saw others standing in the marketplace doing nothing. He told them, 'You also go and work in my vineyard, and I will pay you whatever is right.' So they went. He went out again about noon and about 3 in the afternoon and did the same thing. About 5 in the afternoon, he went out and found still others standing around. He asked them, 'Why have you been standing here all day long doing nothing?' 'Because no one has hired us,' they answered. He said to them, 'You also go and work in my vineyard.' When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, 'Call the workers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last ones hired and going on to the first.' The workers who were hired about 5 in the afternoon came and each received a denarius. So when those came who were hired first, they expected to receive more. But each one of them also received a denarius. When they received it, they began to grumble against the landowner. 'Those who were hired last worked only 1 hour,' they said, 'and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the work and the heat of the day.' But he answered one of them, 'I am not being unfair to you, friend. Didn't you agree to work for a denarius? Take your pay and go. I want to give the one who was hired last the same as I gave you. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? Or are you envious because I am generous?' So the last will be first, and the first will be last." We're going to leave our reading there for the moment. We will return to it later in our service. Let me invite you to open your Bibles at Matthew chapter 19. Matthew chapter 19, and then into chapter 20, words that we read earlier on. Please keep your Bible open as we study these truths. A few days ago, many of us probably heard of Dan Price for the first time. There was an article about this man, Dan Price, on the BBC News website under the title of "The Employer Who Pays All of His Staff $70,000. Sounds good, doesn't it? Well, so if you clicked on the article, you find out a little bit more about this guy, Dan Price. He is a very wealthy businessman. He started up his own company. It's worth a significant amount of money. He was slightly convicted having a conversation with one of his staff members one day about how they were struggling financially. And he took the decision there and then that every single person on his payroll would get paid the same amount. They would get paid $70,000 per annum. For most people, this was a doubling of their salary. But just in case people thought that he was expecting everyone else to be on one level and him on another, he also decided that he would bin his $1 million salary per year and that he would sell most of his shares to fund this new way of looking after his staff. So because he's done this, he's gained a degree of popularity. He speaks in different events in the US about the inequality of wealth and how this can be addressed in different ways. Well, we may read something about Dan Price and we may conclude, well, maybe he's just like the guy in the story that Jesus told. Jesus tells special stories. They're called parables. They're stories with a spiritual meaning. And in this story, there is an employer who pays all of his staff the same. So basically, what we have with Dan Price is not just a modern equivalent of the guy in Jesus' story with a spiritual meaning. Well, the answer is not really. Because while there is an equality in what the guys were getting paid who went to work for this vineyard owner, and while there is a very generous person within this particular parable that Jesus speaks, Jesus is speaking on an entirely different level. Jesus is not speaking about material inequality. Jesus is speaking about spiritual truths. So let's make sure we understand what's going on here. Well, in the story that Jesus communicates, it's not an unusual story in that sense. It's really quite normal, especially at harvest time, when because of the weather, it would be key that the grapes would be picked at exactly the right time. And so the owner goes out at 6 a.m. to the marketplace. And the marketplace in Jesus' day was the equivalent of the Job Center Plus or S1Jobs.com. It was the place where you would gain employment. And he goes in at 6 a.m. He sees these guys who are looking for work. He agrees a deal with them. For the day, you get a denarius. It's a decent wage. It's what the soldiers of the day got. It was good for that day. The problem was it was perhaps unreliable. You didn't know what was going to come the next day. We think zero-hour contracts are something modern. Well, this is the equivalent of a zero-hour contract. But the guys were in agreement. We'll do the work for you. You'll give us this pay. And off they go. But the owner of this vineyard decides that it's crucial all his work gets done in this one day. So he goes back again 3 hours later, this time 9 in the morning. There's other guys still hanging about. Oh, listen, you don't have a job yet? Come here. For the day, you'll get a denarius. And off they go. But he comes back again at midday. He comes back again at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He even comes back at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, 1 hour before closing time as it was in the time of Jesus. And he's saying to them, listen, you're going to go and work for me. This is what you're going to do. And so they all went and they all worked and everything is fine until verse 8. Because in verse 8, in the story with a spiritual meaning that Jesus is telling, when the foreman goes to start paying the people, there is grumbling. There is unsettling. The people who had been working for an hour, they were given their pay, then for 3 hours given their pay, 6 hours given their pay, 9 hours given their pay, 12 hours given their pay. And the guys who'd done 12 hours are going, hang on, there's something just not quite right here, guys. There's something inherently unfair in this whole system. You can't possibly pay them the same as you paid us. And so we have the beginnings of an industrial dispute. And perhaps ACAS or one of these reconciliation services may be called in to try and resolve this industrial dispute. Because even although the employer has kept his end of the bargain, there's still this grumbling that's going on. And so it comes to the key verse. If you want to know what the key verse of this story with a spiritual meaning is, if you've got your own Bibles here, you've got a pen or a pencil, underline verse 15. Because verse 15 is the key teaching here. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my money? Or are you envious because I am generous? This is the key verse from this passage here. Because this is not about, for those of you who employ people, it's not about you going back later on today or tomorrow morning and rewriting how you recruit people and rewriting how you remunerate people. That's not what this is about. It's not about equality of humanity before God or everyone's equal in that kind of sense. That's not what it's about either. It's not about earning our way to God, that if we work for a certain period of time that we're somehow worth more in God's sight or we can earn our way to God. It's not about that at all. The key thrust of this story with a spiritual meaning is the generosity of this landowner. And if you extrapolate from that, you are then being pointed to the fact that the key verse is telling us about the generosity of God. And so this is a message here that speaks about the nature of God. And that's the direction of travel that we have this morning. We're going to look at this teaching of Jesus. We've been careful not to look at every single detail of the parables of Jesus, because it's not designed to be broken up into all these different component parts, and this part means this and that part means that. You look back, you stand back, and you look at the whole. This is talking about the generosity of God. And so we're going to think today about the nature of God. Because if God were to be personified, put into a person as it were, then the way in which this person would deal with individuals would be so different, which is what we have here. I want us to see two things. I want us to see, first of all, that God is gracious. And then after that, I want us to see the connected truth that God is sovereign. God is gracious and God is sovereign. Picture the scene as we begin thinking of God being gracious. You're trying to find an address. You've got an address of somebody's house and you're trying to find it, and you're driving slowly along the road. And you see house number 3. You're looking for number 5. You say, okay, that's number 3. Well, beside it on either side must be either number 5 or 7 or number 2 or number 4. Or maybe it's across the road. But you don't see anything on one side, and beside number 3, you see number 16, and you're going, oh, I had the bus. Where's all the other houses gone? And you're looking over there. No, there's none of these numbers are there. And you're going, how on earth did they order this? It makes no sense whatsoever. If you ever try and find a house in Rizauri, down where we stay, that's the kind of confusion you're going to have, because the numbers are all over the place. I'm saying that from the point of view, when we come to chapter 20, almost ignore the fact you're in a new chapter. Because the chapter divisions of the Bible were not there in the original scripts. So the scroll that had the Gospel of Matthew did not have chapter 1 and chapter 2 and chapter 3 and whatever. They were added later, almost like an address system, so that you would know where to find the truth of God. And so on some occasions, it doesn't make a huge amount of sense as to why the chapter division is put there, just as why number 16 is beside number 3. It doesn't make much sense in some places you're trying to find. So chapter 20, that probably shouldn't be there, because from verse 27 onwards, you've got the same theme. It's linked here, verse 30 and verse 16. Many who are first will be last, and many who are last will be first. Jesus links that again in verse 16 of chapter 20. Last will be first will be last. Because what's going on here is the very same thing. So what happened in chapter 19? Well, the disciples were stunned. Absolutely stunned. Because this guy, he was young, who was rich, who was influential, who had all the external trappings of being one chosen by God and blessed by God. Jesus said how hard it is for someone like that to enter the kingdom of heaven. Because his God was riches and comfort. And so the disciples are a bit bemused. Well, listen, who else can be saved? And Jesus speaks in chapter 19 about things that are possible, impossible for us. They're not impossible for God. In that light, Peter then comes and he speaks and he says, we've left everything to follow you. So what's it going to be for us? And again, there's a sense of discomfort when you hear something like this. Just as there was a sense of discomfort in previous occasions where the disciples are arguing which one of them is going to be the greatest. Who's going to be the first in the kingdom? You're in the company of Jesus and you're talking about the greatest. You think you're going to be the greatest? You're in the company of Jesus now, Peter, and you say, listen, we've left everything to follow you. You're in the company of the one who's left glory and adoration and praise in heaven above you. You're really honestly saying these words when he's left that to be here? Now, to an extent, it's technically true. They did leave their careers behind. They did leave their families for spells. They would, as time would go by, they would be guilty by association. That's true. However, that does not mean that they are somehow more special and precious and loved in the eyes of God than other people are. And so Jesus then gives this parable to explain that whole scenario. He's telling them here that in this story with a spiritual meaning, he's telling them here that it doesn't really matter whether they've been there right at the very start or whether they've got this 11th hour conversion, everyone who comes to God is experiencing the same grace that is undeserved, that's given to us by a generous God. Let me illustrate how it's made most stark in this story. Think of the guys who were hired at 5 p.m. They've been there hanging about all day. and nobody's hired them. And you're left asking the question, why has nobody hired them? The landowner himself comes and says that. He comes in verse 6, why are you standing here all day long doing nothing? The answer, nobody hired us. Why? If it's harvest time and this particular landowner is looking for staff, pretty sure other people might be looking for staff as well. Why are they not being hired? Because the likelihood is they're the type of people that employers don't want to hire. They're the type of people who are left behind for a reason. Maybe they're lazy. Maybe they were unfit. Who knows what it was? But they weren't wanted. And these people who weren't wanted by all these others are finding in this generous landowner somebody who does want them. And who wants them, and who is going to be generous to them. He's going to employ them, he's going to bless them, he's going to do good things for them. He invites them to come and to work and to serve him. But they'll only be there for an hour, that's true. And they may be unwanted, but they're not unwanted by this generous landowner. The guy who wrote this gospel under the inspiration of God's Spirit has been teaching us this time and again through this gospel. He's been telling us that the people that others don't want are the ones that God does. So whether it's the little children, or whether it's the leper, or whether it's the centurion, or whether it's the blind men, or whether it's some of the women that he comes into contact with, time and again, Jesus is engaging with whom? He's engaging with the people that others would regard as the last, and others would regard as the least. Jesus comes and he deals with them, and he brings them to himself in a remarkable way. And if there was going to be some type of way of finding out just how useful people would have appeared to from the outside to Jesus and his cause, well, these little children, what possible use would they have? And yet Jesus makes a point of being with them. The leper, what possible usefulness can a leper have? And yet Jesus reaches out and touches them. What possible use can these guys have been hanging about all day, do nothing? Well, Jesus is a use for them. And when they receive their payment, they are realizing, wow, we don't deserve this. Which is very true. But none of them deserve it. Because if we're talking about the nature of God here, and we're talking about God being generous, and we're talking about God dealing with the last, just as he would deal with the first, we're realizing that whether first or whether last, every single one is a recipient of the grace of God. There is nobody that somehow deserves what God will give to us. We can't earn our way to God. It's one of the great heresies that has come down the generations that somehow, if we just do the right things, and if these right things are somehow more numerous than the bad things, the wrong things that we've done, we're going to be fine. It doesn't work that way. Every single one of us is dependent on God dealing with us in a way that we don't deserve. Receiving his unmerited, his undeserved mercy and grace. And whether we see ourselves as being among the last and among the least, what would anybody want with us? What would God want with someone like us? Someone like us who has got such struggles in this direction and that direction. We're not like some of these people who seem to have it all together. What would God want with someone like us? Well, God wants our hearts. And God in his grace is going to capture our hearts. And he's going to capture our hearts in a way that transforms our lives. But you may sit there and say, yeah, but is there not something just distinctly unfair about all of this? Is there not something unfair about God dealing with these people at the 11th hour, just as he would deal with others? So is grace versus fairness, human fairness, is that a thing? Well, the thing about human fairness is that if we transported human fairness onto the kind of divine level, and God is going to be fair, then there's no hope. That's the bottom line. If God was going to be fair to me or to you, whether you would class yourself as one of these 11th hour people or you're there right at the very beginning, you've lived this very outwardly model life for decades on end, and people would struggle to point a finger at you and say, well, yes, this is an obvious flaw or failing or sin in that person's life. Whether you're either into these extremes or somewhere in between, if God was going to be fair, then every single one of us, without exception, would be cast from the presence of God. None of us could be accepted in God's sight if God was being fair. The Bible says everyone has sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Every single one of us. So if we want fairness from God, all you're doing is putting yourself on death row. Because if God's going to be fair, then there is no hope for any of us. God, in his mercy, his grace transcends any notion of human fairness. And God, in his grace, gives us two things. He gives to us gifts that we could never, ever possibly deserve. And likewise, he takes away from us the punishments that we do deserve. And if the landowner in this parable is really generous, then how much more generous is the God of grace? We forget about the grace of God that has brought us to life spiritually. We're in a really dangerous position. Because it's only the grace of God that has brought us to life, and it's only the grace of God that has enabled us to serve him for however long or short period that might be. It's all down to the grace of God, his undeserved dealings with us. So if God is gracious, he's also sovereign. And they're tied together, these things. They're tied together in the sense that God has mercy upon whom he has mercy. That's what Romans chapter 9 tells us. And you say, well, that's unfair. Remember, fairness, every single one of us is cast from the presence of God. God in his sovereignty, however, he calls people at different stages of life to come and to follow him and to experience his grace. So some people are called to follow God from their earliest days. So in the Bible, we can think of some examples of that. We can think of John the Baptist. He was someone who was set apart from the womb, very special. Okay, maybe not exactly in the same level as John the Baptist, but think of Timothy. He is somebody from a really young age who loved Jesus, who followed Jesus. Some of the people in this room today are those who began to follow Jesus before you were age 10. That you knew you loved him and you wanted to follow him. And even although there were various different things in your life from that stage to where you're at now, that's when God in his grace began working in your life. It's good to see some of the younger ones here. It's great to see some of the kind of Sunday Club guys coming in for the service. And let me kind of say to you guys, some of you guys are probably older than 10 now. But even people younger than 10 come to know and to trust Jesus and to follow him, to love him. That's what God sometimes does to people. In their earliest days, he brings them to himself. They're the 6 a.m. employees. Other people, it's in the prime of life that God calls us. In the prime of life, you think of some of the disciples. They're out there, they're kind of earning a living, they're providing for their families. They get the call of God upon their lives. You think of the Apostle Paul. He's a guy who's destined for the top. His conduct, his knowledge, his enthusiasm, his passion, he's destined for the top, and yet he's called by God in his grace to live. And some of you today are in the prime of life. We still are, some of us. Depends what that definition might be. But in the prime of life, have you come to experience that grace of God yet? Some of you have. How wonderful. Some of you still need to. You say, oh yeah, but are there not others? Yes, there are, because God in his sovereign work, when he has mercy on whom he has mercy, he'll also work even right up until the last minute with some people. Not with everybody. With some people. Classic example we have of that is the thief on the cross, is it not? This is a guy who in his life had rejected and rebelled against God, hence his conduct and the behavior that he had. He's seen, however, in God's sovereign purposes, in the last hours of his life, he has seen Jesus in a way that we haven't seen Jesus. Because you and I look at Jesus and we look up to a cross and we think he's on that cross because of me. What's keeping him on that cross is his love for a wreck like me. This thief on the cross, he didn't look up, he looked along. Because he saw that he's on a cross himself, and he's looking to somebody on a cross, and he's praying to somebody on a cross. He knows that this Jesus is innocent. He knows he's not innocent, but he knows that Jesus is. God, in his sovereign work, opened that guy's eyes. So the first time in history, and probably the only time in history, someone dying on a cross prays to somebody dying on a cross. And so he's transformed, and you think, wonderful. It is wonderful. It's remarkable. But remember, there was a guy on the other side of Jesus as well. And he looked, and he did not see anything in Jesus that he was going to somehow stop hurling abuse at him. But God in his sovereign work acts at different ages and stages. And so you could be young today, you could be in the prime of life, you could be nearing the end of your days. And God in his sovereign power can work, because when God calls us effectively by the power of his Spirit to life, we experience his grace. And it's his grace on the behest of his sovereign call. God is gracious. And God is sovereign. And these are truths that meet together. So if these are the teachings, what are the applications? Well, the applications are twofold. Number one, there's an application as to how we view ourselves and others if we've experienced this grace of God. There is a particular issue, I think, that every congregation, whether it's a large congregation or a small congregation, could be susceptible to. And it partly follows on the thinking of Peter. Well, we've done all this for you, so therefore, what are you going to do for us? The Bible does make clear to us that rewards are given by God according to how people have worked and how people are served. That's all God's prerogative, and that's in God's purposes. But the danger that can sometimes creep in to congregations is that those who have spent many years, perhaps decades, serving, those who have given much of their income, those who have supported prayerfully, practically, can find themselves in a situation where they see new folks, less experienced, less committed, perhaps serving in less ways, come in and see the dynamic changed and realize that influence doesn't necessarily remain where it once did. It's a great thing when you see someone who has borne the heat and burden of the day over many decades react graciously to new people coming in, seeking to serve in perhaps slightly different ways, but serving with a focus on God. It's a remarkable thing to see that grace in action, because so often it can be the other way. Now, of course, this is nothing against those who have borne the heat and burden of the day. Where on earth would this congregation be or other congregations be if there weren't people who've borne the heat and burden of the day? Of course, it's a remarkable thing that people have experienced grace and God's grace has kept them. But that attitude of Peter can creep in. Well, what about us? And the response of Jesus in that is to remind Peter of the generosity of God in his sovereign grace towards us and towards others. It is by grace we've been saved, and it is by grace we've been able to serve. And if new people are now being saved and new people are able to serve alongside us, wonderful. But let's be aware. And we don't need to be in the Christian path very long to realize that there's a tendency for this to happen. What about us? That mentality can creep in, as it did here with Peter, in the presence of Jesus. So, how do we view ourselves? We view ourselves as those who are defined by grace. Preachers or missionaries are no more higher up than the person who's just been converted that last second. We've all experienced the same grace at the same sovereign hand. Those who've been serving for decades upon decades and those who've been coming to serve for mere minutes have received the same grace. When we keep our eyes on that grace, we see the wonder that God would call people like us and use people like us in His service. So the what about us? We need to be aware of that. The second application, if that's the application as to how do we view ourselves and others, the second application is how do we view the urgency of responding to Jesus Christ? We can read a parable like this, story of a spiritual meaning, and think, 11th hour, perfect. That's the one for me. That's the one for me. I'm not going to give my whole life to Jesus. Don't be daft. But likewise, I don't want to go to hell. I mean, when the Bible talks about hell, that is not a place I don't want to go anywhere near there. Who in their right mind would want to go to hell? For me, if I got it planned out my way, because, you know, I try to make sure I've got my finger in all the pies, and I've got a degree, I've got a plan, I've got a life plan here, I'm going to have this sorted. It's going to be the 11th hour for me. Well, that's very dangerous. Because that 11th hour comes at a time that you don't know. Those of you who have experienced, having given birth and watched people kind of give birth, you know that sometimes there's these whole kind of pregnancy plans and, you know, in the meetings beforehand and you get all, and, oh yes, we're going to do this and you're going to do that and you're going to do the next thing, and then you realize when a baby's coming. That's the bottom line. And the pregnancy plan can get horsed out the window. You don't know when that 11th hour is going to come. That's the point. And so many people think, oh, the 11th hour, yeah, it's going to work for me. In my 16 years of ministry, I can only recall of one person that I had any dealings with at the 11th hour that I think came to a faith. One person. And I've done hundreds of funerals. One person. The far more likely scenario is what I met early on in my naive years of ministry in Ullapool. I was called to this guy's house. He was riddled with cancer. He literally had only a few days to go. It was evident that was the case. I'd never met the guy at all. He phoned up, asked if I would come and speak to him, maybe do his funeral. And I said, okay, that's fine. We'll have a chat. Had a chat. I said, listen, we need to talk about spiritual things. And he went, no, no. He got angry. He got angry very, very quickly. He said, no, I'm going to have none of that spiritual nonsense. I want nothing to do with it. If you think, having lived my life against God, that now suddenly I'm going to change my mind and depend on God, you've got another thing coming. No, I don't want to hear anything about it. And you think, oh, people aren't that hard. They are. Because the longer we reject the invitation to live that Jesus gives to us, the harder we become. You don't leave this building today in the same way as you came into it. Every one of us has changed. We are either being changed and molded and shaped to be made more like Jesus Christ, or we are getting hardened in our rejection and rebellion against God. You cannot look at a parable like this and think, I'm going to be the 11th hour, because I guarantee you, you will not know when the 11th hour is. And when that time comes, if you have continually rejected Jesus, you're going to be so hardened, you will be like that guy who wants nothing to do with anything spiritual. You see, the application for you today is this. It might be the 11th hour. None of us know when that's going to come. So today might be the 11th hour, and this could be the last opportunity. So what do you do? Well, there is a generous, a gracious, sovereign God who is coming to you today, and He's going, why are you still standing there in that position? Why are you still there? With that threat of judgment and death hanging over you, come and follow me. Look at my son. Look at the gift I've given to you. Look at my son and all of his wonder and all of his beauty and his purity and truth. And look at what he's done and how he engages with people and how he welcomes those who've messed up. Listen, you tick all the boxes. Come and see him. Come and listen to what he says. And then if you open your eyes and you look and you open your ears and you think, well, what is it about him? Well, he says this. He says, come to me and I'll never turn you away. So today, the application for you is to come right now. Is to come as you are. Not trying to improve yourself or fix yourself or do whatever you think needs to get done, because you're not going to be able to do that. It is to come now before him and beg him for his grace, his forgiveness, his cleansing. There is a gracious God who is generous, who in his sovereign purposes has brought you here today to hear this invitation to live, or brought you to watch on that screen this invitation to live. In his sovereignty, he has done that. In his grace, he's calling you to his son. What will you do with Jesus today? Let's finish there.